very holistic perspective when I'm doing this show and living my life and practicing with clients. And that means the goal in life to me is finding a balance between body, mind, and spirit. And basically, the way that works is developing a greater and greater consciousness of how all of these aspects of us are communicating to us on a regular basis. And the more conscious we get of this communication, what our body's saying to us, what our mind's saying to us, what our inner voice, intuition, spirit voice, God voice, whatever you want to call it, heart, the more conscious we get about these, and when these voices inside of us are really speaking from a higher place. And to me, that is really the difficult part for most people, is how to discern between what is that higher voice and what is that base voice that really is just trying to perpetuate our pain and insanity. So the show every week deals with a variety of issues. This is a live call-in show, and so my topic today is the single side of love. I know I do shows all the time on relationships, how to get into them, how to heal them, how to have healthy ones. Today we're going to be talking about the single side of love with my guest, who I'll be introducing in a couple of minutes, Dr. Gary Chapman, who wrote a book with that title, The Single Side of Love. So as I said, it is a live show. Call in if you're in the Phoenix area. The phone number is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the internet, as I know some of you are because I get your emails and occasionally a call from outside Arizona, the number is still the same. It's a toll call for you, but feel free to call in. It's 480-949-1310. Now, if you go to my website, tellthetruthfaster.com, I have all my shows archived. And I've done a lot of shows over the last 3 years, and it's hard to believe it's been 3 years of doing this show, on relationships. And a bottom line to my philosophy about relationships is, when I'm talking about relationships, I'm not just talking about a relationship we might or might not have or wish to have or have had in the past with a significant or other or a primary person in our life, like a spouse, a partner, husband, wife, lover, whatever. So I've done many shows on that. I've done actually relatively few shows on what singles equate as love. But in those shows, taking a cue from one of my teachers, Sandra Ray, in her book, Loving Relationships, she talks about the fact that we are in relationship with everyone and everything in our lives. And I've said this many times, and I believe it firmly. We have an intimate relationship with our bodies, an intimate relationship with money, an intimate relationship with our career path, as well as family, friends. I mean, if you want to take it down to, many of us have a very intimate relationship with our car, or lack of. And very often these things exhibit our belief systems and programming about relationship and intimacy and love. And if you're single and you look around you and you see that there's chaos and lack of security and, you know, not enough in your mind about all these other connections you have, the work to me that needs to be done is still similar to the work that needs to be done when we're dealing with a significant other. And very often what that entails, and when I'm working with a couple, it's very common, a lot of therapists will tell you the same thing. You get a couple in the room who've been in the relationship for a short term or a long term, and very often the conflict that they're exhibiting is, in a sense, two vocabularies, and they're not realizing that they're trying to communicate with one another, speaking two different languages. One may be more intellectualized and heady. One may be constantly a language of emotions and feelings. And when you're not aware of the others, it's almost as if they're speaking a language you don't understand. And when I help them understand the differences, usually this light goes off, and then I help them practice learning each other's vocabulary and trying to communicate in the other's vocabulary. And that's what today's show, I think, is partially going to be about, because what Dr. Chapman talks about in his book is the five love languages. And in this case, today we're talking about his newest book, The Five Love Languages for Singles. So I'd like to introduce and welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, Dr. Gary Chapman, who's from North Carolina.
Great to be with you.
Well, thank you.
With my southern accent and all.
Say again?
With my southern accent and all.
Well, I love it, actually. My ex-wife was from Mississippi, so I
Okay.
So you heard me start by talking about the differences in vocabularies and languages that seem to be a problem for many couples. What do you mean by the five love languages? Let's start with that.
Well, I'm dealing exactly with what you're talking about, because in my own counseling with couples through the years, I early discovered that what makes one person feel loved doesn't make another person feel loved.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, like you and many others, tried to help couples connect on that. And what I did, after a while, I realized, you know, I'm hearing the same things over and over and over again as to what people wanted in terms of feeling love. So what I did, actually, was sit down and go through 20 years of my own counseling notes, the notes I made as I was counseling people, and ask myself, when someone said to me, I feel like my spouse doesn't love me, what did they want? And I had it in my notes. And so when I put all these together and laid them out, they fell into these five categories. And so I call them the five love languages.
Which are?
One is words of affirmation, using words to affirm the other person, verbal affirmation. A second love language is acts of service, doing things that you know the person would like for you to do. You remember the old saying, actions speak louder than words.
Definitely.
And that's true for some people. If this is their primary love language, then that is very true.
Mm-hmm.
A third love language is gifts. It's universal. My academic background actually is anthropology.
I have a minor in that.
Oh, do you really? Yeah. And we've never found a culture where gift-giving is not an expression of love.
Mm-hmm.
Universal to give gifts. And then a fourth love language is quality time. By which I mean you're giving the person your undivided attention. You're not watching television together. You're interacting with each other together. You may watch television and then discuss it, and that becomes quality time.
Mm-hmm.
And then physical touch. And we've long known the emotional power of physical touch. That's why we pick up babies and cuddle them.
Mm-hmm.
And long before the baby understands the meaning of the word love, the baby feels love by touch.
So there's also a healing factor in that, too. I've been aware for a long time that what's the first thing that a mother does when a baby falls down? She puts her hand on the baby's boo-boo.
Yes.
You know, and immediately there's comfort involved in that.
Absolutely.
And there's a healing, and there's a hands-on healing of an energy that's involved with it, but it's the security that baby's feeling from mom or dad or some loved one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the key idea, Stuart, in this five love language idea is that out of those five languages, everybody has a primary love language. That is, one of these speaks more deeply to them than the other four. And in a relationship, the key to continuing an emotional love in the relationship is learning to speak each other's primary love language.
Funny thing. Same words.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, and so when you do that, the person feels loved. And when you don't, after a while, they begin to feel like, you know, I don't think they really love me. Even though you're speaking love in another language, but it's not connecting with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the key idea. And the original book, of course, was written for couples, married couples, trying to help them keep love alive in the relationship. And what happened was I had a lot of single adults who said to me, you know, Gary, I know you wrote that book for couples, but I read it, and it really helped me understand my mother or some other relationship, you know.
Right.
And so singles said, you know, why don't you write one just for singles and their relationship? So that's really where this book came from. It was a request of singles who had read the original book. So it's been exciting. I've enjoyed writing this book.
Well, let's go through the languages for a minute, and so that we can take them a little deeper and define what you mean by each one. Because in going through these are all, on many of the shows, areas, especially I've done a lot of shows on intimacy, and my definition of intimacy is it's an expression of our natural desire for connection.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the things in your language are things that I talk about very regularly. So to me, someone with your experience, you know, to me it's very affirming to hear someone else talking about the same things. And even, you know, we're talking about various languages in relationship, but one of the beauties of the fact that there are so many therapists out there with varying approaches and so many teachers out there is, at the bottom line, most of us are teaching the same thing, but using our own vocabulary that resonates with some people, and it's the same thing in relationships. Some people may get it the way I put it. Some people may get it the way you put it,
right.
Because of the way we're doing it or approaching it or the words we're using. So the gift in the diversity of approaches and teaching vocabularies is the same thing that you're talking about in the variety of love vocabularies.
Well, I think that's true, Stuart. And the fact is, you know, different people connect even with different personalities.
Right.
You know, you've had this experience and I have. There's some people will go to a counselor and they come away and say, yeah, I don't like that counselor. I'm not going back to that counselor. And it's just that, you know, personality-wise, they didn't connect with that counselor. And then they go to another one and say, oh, I love that guy. You know,
and the person may be saying the same exact thing that the other one said.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But it's a difference in personality or the way they put it or a lot of other things. But, yeah, and of course, what all of us are trying to do is connect with people, meet them where they are, and the fact is a lot of people are hurting, and try to help them build positive relationships. And, of course, what I'm dealing here is with one aspect of a relationship, but a very significant one, and that is the whole thing of feeling loved or feeling deeply appreciated by another person.
Even when you're single and not in a primary relationship.
Right, absolutely.
And that's one of the most difficult things I've seen with a lot of people. Now, I'm 54 years old, and I'm not in a primary relationship now. And there are times when I'm feeling longing and other things like that, and I believe in the show to kind of personalize some of these issues for myself. And it is for me at times a space of comfort and at times a space of struggle.
Right.
So let's go through your languages. Words of affirmation.
Words of affirmation.
Apply this to being single.
There are certain people for whom words, affirming words, speak most deeply to them in terms of love. So let's look at any of the relationships that a single has. Let's take words of affirmation as it relates to a parent, for example. In fact, one of the letters that stimulated my book was a gal who wrote me from Japan, and she said, Dr. Chapman, I read your book for couples, and I just wanted you to know how much it helped me understand my mother. She said, my mother, through all my lifetime, I have perceived her as being a controller. She tried to dominate my life. She said, when I went to college, for example, my mother would show up about every 6 weeks and come in and clean my dorm room. You can imagine how that made her feel.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, when I got out of college, I had a roommate, and when my mother knew that I was going to have someone over for the evening or a group over, she would actually make cookies and bring them over to me. And she said, to me, she was intruding in my life. So she said, actually, the reason I'm in Japan, I'm here teaching English as a second language, but I'm really here to get away from my mother.
Mm-hmm.
But when I read your book, she said, I understood my mother's love language is acts of service, so she's been serving me.
Mm-hmm.
She said, but my love language is words of affirmation, and I didn't get those from my mother.
I need to hear my mom say I love me. I love you.
That's right. You're right. Important. I appreciate what you're doing. You're doing a great job. She said, but my mother was often critical of me. And she said, consequently, you know, I was critical of her because she was dominating my life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she said, I realized my mother was really loving me. She was just speaking her own language. She wasn't speaking my language.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, I wrote my mother and asked her if she would get that book and read it. And she did. And I said, you know, does that help you understand us any better? And she said, of course, Mom got it, too. And she said, we both apologized to each other that we had not, you know, known how to express love to each other. And she said, now, in my emails, my mother gives me words of affirmation. She says positive things to me. And she said, I really feel close to my mother now. And she said, I told Mom, as soon as I get home, I'm going to paint the bedroom for you. She said, I can't do it.
She's going to speak in her language by being
right.
A service. Yeah.
So, you know, there's an example of learning how to speak the other person's language, a very significant relationship, the parent, adult-child relationship, and how it was turned around and healing came when they realized that what had been going on was counterproductive, even though, in this case, her mother was very sincere.
Right. The intentions were there, but not the level or the approach that each perceived was necessary.
Right.
I think one of the other words of affirmation that I really try and teach people is thank you.
Thank you.
Really expressing appreciation and gratitude on a regular basis, it goes a long way with anyone in your life, whether it's an employer or employee or a friend or, you know, somebody in a store that's not being appreciated in terms of their service. And I think gratitude and thank yous are not used near enough in our society.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that, sir. And the thing, the other point is, all of these languages speak to people. You know, anyone feels appreciated or appreciates any of these languages. But if words of affirmation happens to be their primary love language, then you really speak deeply to that person.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a person, and I have a story about this in the book. Here's two singles who are working in the same office, and one of them resents the other one because she feels like the girl is not carrying her load in the office. Okay, but she begins to she comes up with the love language concept and says, okay, now what would happen if I discovered her love language, even though I resent her? If I discovered her language and started to speak it, you know, what would happen? And so she found out her language was words of affirmation, and so she starts giving the gal words of affirmation. She starts looking for things that she can affirm her. But even though she feels, you know, resentful toward her, she's giving her positive words. Well, what happens is the girl turns around and begins to say to her things like, you know, what can I do to help you? Yeah. And so the girl starts, you know, helping her. And then the girl who initiated the whole thing begins to realize, you know, behind what I thought was laziness, there's somebody who really cares, and she's responding, and now she's doing things for me. So, you know, understanding the person's love language, and in that case, the words of affirmation, really creates a different atmosphere between the two people, and consequently, a better relationship.
What do you do with a person who when a person gets a compliment, there are a lot of people who don't know how to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
They, whether it's a self-esteem issue, whether it's lack of feeling deserving or whatever self-criticism going, there are some people that will hear those words and get defensive about it or just push it away. You know, you're wearing a beautiful dress today, oh, this old thing type of thing.
Yeah.
What do you do when somebody is offering those words of affirmation and, I mean, there are some people, whether it's words of affirmation or gifts you're trying to give them or services you're trying to do or even a hug or a touch, being on the receiving end of anything that's speaking of kindness and love and connection is difficult for them.
Yeah. Well, I think two things I would say. One is you have to let the person be where they are, and because of their background, which you may not know, that may be where they are. They're not up to receiving love right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I usually say is, you know, if they come back with a negative comment or kind of brush it off, I say, well, I just want you to know, you know, that's how I felt about it. So at least they walk away hearing the affirmation again, even though they didn't receive it. You've let them be where they are, but you've just affirmed that you've expressed to them what you genuinely thought, or if it's a gift, you know, what you wanted them to have. The other issue I would say with regard to the five love languages is that perhaps what you're doing is speaking a language that is maybe their least important language. So I would say before you give up on that person, I would try one of the other languages, because you may be more effective. They may receive another language much more readily than they do the one you're trying to give.
Good.
So that, you know, that would be the other idea, I think.
And the belief that even if they're not, because sometimes we're saying something kind or giving a gift with the hope of getting something in return.
Right.
You know, that we need to feel appreciated, so we're doing it, and it's not the most altruistic expression of love and caring.
Right.
Even if on a certain level that is your motivation. So sometimes it's important for the person offering the words of affirmation or the gifts or service or whatever to be able to learn what it means to do this unconditionally without expectations of something coming back immediately and know and understand the concept of just subtly planting seeds in the process.
Right. And I think, Stuart, you know, that would be a wonderful experiment for a lot of people. is to recognize, because the opposite is what we usually do. I think normally, you know, we want the relationship to be better, so we say, okay, I'm going to do this. So we do it, and then we sit back and wait, you know, hoping that they'll reciprocate. And when they don't, we get disappointed, and then we say, oh, well, I'm just going to give up. But if we can do an experiment, let's, you know, just set a time limit. So, you know, 3 months, 6 months. I'm going to try to discover this person's love language. I'm going to try to speak it regularly, and I'm just going to see what happens. Well, because we all so desperately need love, if you are speaking their primary love language and you do it consistently in spite of their behavior, there's a good chance that they are going to begin to melt and feel warmly toward you and eventually begin to reciprocate and start doing positive things for you. I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen, a lot of hard, harsh, cruel people, normally there because of lack of love in their past, who, when they do get unconditional love over a period of time, in a language that they really feel, they do begin to warm up. And they're not the hard, harsh, cruel person that they appeared to be. Inside, they now become a warm person to the person who's given them love.
Right. And basically, there was a warm person in there waiting to burst out all the time anyway.
Absolutely.
Now, let's talk about the second one, acts of service. Because very often, especially with singles, when they're saying, I don't know how to meet people, or I'm just feeling real isolated, one of the things they usually suggest to them is go do some volunteer work so that the act of service may not be to a particular person in your life that you feel connected to, but it's a general expression of love and support in your community or to a particular organization. And very often they end up meeting people of like mind and like-heartedness and stuff, and things can start happening from there.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it all grows out of an attitude which says, you know, I'm going to look for some people I can help. Or saying to the people that are already in your sphere of relationships, you know, simple statements in your own words, but what you're trying to communicate is there something I could do to help you? Could I help you with that? And typically, if people need help, they will be responsive to that. And if that is their love language, they will definitely be responsive to that. And they will give you ideas on how you might help them. And when you indeed do help them, they genuinely feel loved by that.
There are some people, actually many people, who don't know how to ask for what they need. And someone can say, how can I be of service to you? And they're at a loss of actually, even when it's being offered, to ask. How do you help someone get past that part of it? In other words, someone's actually coming to them, and they do have a legitimate need to help them get past the receiving end of that service.
I think particularly if you have observed the person, and they are the kind of people who are serving others, because that's what often happens. The people who want to be served are serving others. And that's an indication that that's their love language because they're speaking it to other people. So if you observe this in that person, then I would say take the initiative and just look for something. Think about something you could do for them. And if they're the kind of people who are serving others, then very likely they will be responsive to whatever you do. You know, all of us are kind of programmed in our society. If someone says, how can I help you? We say, oh, I don't know. You know, we're not eager to reach out and tell people what they can do for us.
Right.
But if you see something that needs to be done, then obviously do it, you know. I remember I was with my wife, and we were visiting a couple, and rather than ask, you know, is there something we could do to help, the lady had just experienced the death of her husband, and rather to say, is there anything we can do to help, my wife said, you know, why don't we help you, you know, straighten up things, and dear, why don't you get the vacuum cleaner, and let's vacuum for her, because her friends are going to be coming over. And so, you know, we just started cleaning the lady's house up, my wife and I, and the lady was deeply appreciative of it. But she wouldn't have said to us, you know, well, you know, it'd be nice if you'd get the vacuum cleaner back in my house,
right.
You know. But when you see things that obviously need to be done or can be done, then typically people are responsive to that.
And a person who's in such a state, like in grief and stuff, where their minds aren't even focused on that, and sometimes they're needing someone to take the lead and just do, you know, bring over a covered dish, or just say, you know what, I'm going to stay here tonight. I don't, you know, so you're not alone. I'll sleep on the couch downstairs. If you need anything, I'll just be down here.
Right.
Because it's what a lot of people want, but certainly feel like I can't impose on someone asking them to stay over.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So when we, you know, when we're talking about acts of service and stuff, I also, the flip side of that to me sometimes is the codependent individual who is thriving on doing for others, and like I said before in terms of words of affirmation, because they're needing the acknowledgement so much. I see this in a lot of the nonprofit work I've done over the years, where there's a certain contingent of volunteers where that volunteerism becomes their life. And when they're not thanked in the right way or enough or whatever, they usually are so burnt out by that point that they leave in a huff and, you know, with ill feelings.
Right.
So how do you deal with that, you know, I'll use the word codependent individual for lack of a better word right now, who's really doing it more out of need than out of graciousness?
Well, I think, Stuart, a good question all of us need to ask when we are doing acts of service is, am I doing this for the people I'm serving, or am I doing this for me? Now, we can't always answer that truthfully and honestly because we don't always understand ourselves.
And maybe the answer is a little bit of both.
That's right.
Not necessarily something wrong with that.
That's right. But it is a good place to start.
Yeah.
Because it also, when we can see that and think of it in those terms, it gives me the freedom not to do it. You know, I don't have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can say, am I doing it for them or am I doing it for myself? And if it's for myself, and it's pretty easy to say, okay, I don't have to do that. I'm doing it for myself. I don't have to do that. If I feel like I'm honestly doing it for them, well, I still don't have to do it because love is a gift, always a gift, if it's true love.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing it because I feel like I have to do it, then it's really slavery. You know, I'm enslaved by my actions here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a big difference between being a servant to someone else and being a slave of someone.
Right.
So what we want and what we're trying to do when we talk about love is it's doing something freely for the benefit of the other person. And yes, I certainly, there's going to be benefits coming back to me just for one thing, just the pleasure of having loved, you know, having done something in love. That in itself is meaningful to me. Whether or not the other person actually reciprocates and loves me. So it is a two-way street, but in true love, our concern is basically for the other person far more than it is for ourselves.
And you know, like my definition of intimacy or intimate love is an expression of our natural desire for connection. And to me, when you're really in it and when you really get it, it's a natural flow. It's effortless.
Yeah.
You don't have to think about it. You don't have to struggle with it. It just flows naturally. And to me, that's another telltale sign when you're on the right track or maybe showing up in a way that really is of service unconditionally.
Well, and I think that's particularly true, Stuart, when it's mature love. You know, we don't always start there, but that's certainly what we hope. That's where we hope to get.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a lot of times in with married couples, I find that they've lost the euphoria of the in love experience,
mm-hmm.
and now they've had some conflicts and they've seen each other's weaknesses, and so they don't have any positive feelings. But they're married and they want the marriage to work, and so what I'm saying to them is, look, if you discover the love language of your spouse and you begin to speak it, even though you're not emotionally motivated to speak it, but you are intellectually motivated because you want to enhance the relationship, you begin to speak it, then they begin to feel warmly because you're speaking their language, and then when they begin to reciprocate, it's when you begin to feel warmly toward them. So the emotional aspect of the relationship can come back, but it didn't really start with a warm emotion. It started with the idea that I want to improve this relationship.
Right.
No, this is a way to do it.
Now, that got us back to actually someone who's in a relationship, to kind of get back to how we're dealing with singles. From what you're saying so far, I gather that your book on the five love languages for couples is basically the same five love languages, only for singles. It's about not having a specific or primary focus of these actions or words or expressions, but being able to do this in general throughout your life, at work, at home, with family, you know, with the clerk at the store or whatever, as a way of grounding oneself and healing your own wounds even while not in a primary relationship. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, Stuart. And what I'm doing in the book is I'm applying this concept to specific relationships. For example, I do deal with the parental relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some singles have good relationships with parents. They've always felt loved by their parents. And then there's a lot of singles who don't feel loved by their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying, as an adult, you know, you understanding the love languages may help you reconnect with your parents. Because if you start speaking your parents' love language and then they begin to feel differently towards you, that relationship can find a lot of healing. So I have, you know, I have a chapter on that. And then I also deal with roommates. Because as you know, whether it's a college roommate or whether it's, you know, people living together after they're out of college and working.
Or even seniors that are now living with a friend or in a nursing home or something.
Right. So I deal with those relationships and how that, the understanding the love language of the person speaking it enhances those relationships. And then I deal with coworkers. And then I do deal with the dating relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there is a dating relationship, you know, here is a way to enhance that relationship. And particularly, this becomes significant after you come down off the in-love high. You know, the in-love experience is almost effortless. You meet
the obsessive part of it.
Yeah, that's right. You meet them, you have a tingle, you know, you start going out together, it gets singlier. And eventually you are actually obsessed with them. In fact, that's the best definition I have of the in-love experience, is it's an emotional obsession.
Mm-hmm.
And the person is just incredibly wonderful. Intellectually, you know that they're not perfect, but in every other way, in your mind, they're just perfect.
And very often you see the red flags, but you're wearing blinders because for some reason you may be so hungry for the fantasy of being in love or having a partner because so many other people do, and you feel so isolated and alone because you feel like the only single person in the world.
Right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Dorothy Tennant did a long-term study on the in-love experience in her book, Love and Limerence, and she determined that the average lifespan of that obsessive stage is 2 years, which means some's a little longer, some's a little less, but the average is 2 years. Then we come down off the high.
I'm surprised it lasts that long.
Yeah, okay.
My experience with most clients, it's more like 6 months.
Yeah. We come back to reality. Now, many times in a dating relationship, it's the people are really well matched, but now they've lost that obsession, and they think to themselves, oh, no, I don't have the feelings I used to have. And what am I going to do? This is not right. And what I'm saying to them is, if you understand that you have the obsessive stage, then you have the more intentional stage. And this is where the five love languages come in. If you discover each other's love language and you begin to speak each other's love language, then you continue to have emotional warmth in the relationship. It's not the obsessive stage, you don't have, but you have warm feelings for each other. And now you can go on exploring the possibility of this relationship and looking at the other aspects of life and really make a wise decision about whether you should get married or whether the relationship can continue or not continue. But if you don't meet that emotional need for love, you come down off the high, the love tank is empty, you don't feel emotional warmth in the relationship, and so you just drift apart. And many, many really healthy relationships could be sustained if people understood and applied the concepts of the five love languages.
Well, I think there's an issue you're touching on here also that I find very common, is that obsessive or emotional high and ultra-romanticized stage is something that a lot of us are addicted to, that adrenaline rush type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And while the next stage we may be entering into may be deeper and more profound and actually more grounded, we think something's missing. We think something's lost and that we're not in love anymore because we're not feeling that adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
And people sometimes are not recognizing the peace of that relationship with being in love.
I think that's right, Stuart. I think that's why people like you and me and others have got to continue to try to help people understand the nature of love. You know, just the simple idea that there's stages. Most people don't have the concept because, you know, they're into the movies and they're into the songs and, you know, they're all talking about all this high romantic stuff. And so when they have it, they feel like, oh, this is wonderful. When they don't have it, they feel like, oh, this relationship's got to go.
Or something's wrong with me.
Yeah, or something's wrong with me.
Right.
So if we can help people better understand the nature of emotional love in our society, then in my opinion, we're gonna see a lot more stable relationships through the years.
Now, I want to bring up something that you mentioned in Chapter 1 that I told you earlier that I have a different opinion on, and you describe love as a learned emotion. My experience and my belief system says that this newborn infant is born totally in that light of love, and it's just a natural expression, which I think is why infants can be so healing. You know, there could be arguing going on in a room, and a baby walks in, and all of a sudden everybody gets quiet and goo-gooed.
Yeah.
And I think as we're growing up in most of our households, because of our parents or other adults who have been taught to put up walls and barriers and messages we've gotten, that natural expression of light and love gets clouded over. And I think as we're adults going through the healing process, the goal is to clean up all the stuff that's covering what's naturally in there. So I'd like you to comment about, for me, it's not a learned emotion. It's something that is the essence of our humanity and our aliveness. And what we're learning at this stage of our lives is how not to let other things interfere with that natural expression.
Well, I wouldn't strongly disagree with what you're saying, Stuart. I do think that we are certainly born with the need to love. I think we're born with a capacity to love, both to give love and receive love. And I think it is at the very heart of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I was saying in that statement more in my mind is that we have to learn how to express love. We have to learn how to connect with people.
Right.
That doesn't always come natural.
Right.
For example, here's a mother. And I would say, you know, it's natural for a mother to love the child. It just kind of comes with the territory. But the fact is, we have a lot of children who are 10, 11, 12 years old who don't feel love.
Right.
And yet the mother would say, oh, I love the child. But the child doesn't feel love. So there's a difference in the mother naturally loving the child and the child feeling that love. And again, that's where the five love languages comes in. But if the mother can learn to speak that child's primary love language, then the child's going to feel love.
Right.
But if they don't, the parents can be sincere, but the children still not be getting it. And I think that's the part that really has to be learned.
And it may be that the parents haven't had anybody speaking their language, and that's why the kids are not getting what they need. You know, when we're dealing with relationships, you talked about when you're working with singles, very often it's the parental relationship that they're working on healing. And my experience has also showed me that very often we end up in a primary relationship with someone who looks awfully close to either our mother or father because we have some unresolved stuff there. And we keep repeating those same relationships until we heal that primary relationship with mom and dad.
Yeah.
And then we end up in a healthier situation.
Yeah.
So for singles dealing with the parental issues, I think what you said is right on, because very often it does get back. I had a client this morning, it was the first session with him, and I've known his parents. He's 22, and I've known his parents for a long time. And his dad, he knows how to yell and knows how to intimidate and stuff like that. He's not a physically violent person. But all of a sudden, this 22-year-old who spent his lifetime being HIV positive since birth, and all of a sudden now he's tapping into his own anger.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it scared him because I said, who did it sound like when you said that? He said, it was like my dad was coming out of my mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it scared me.
Right. And let's say, Stuart, that client, that his primary love language is words of affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's hearing from his father are all these negative words. It hurts him even more deeply than it would hurt someone else.
Yes.
It's going to hurt anyone, but if that's his primary love language, then those words strike even more deeply to his heart. So, you know, understanding the love languages has a lot to do also with parenting children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in this singles edition I have a chapter for single parents. You know, single parents are often stressed for time and finances and a lot of other things. But if they understand the concept of the love languages and that the child has a particular love language, and they can focus in on giving heavy doses of that, speak all five, but give heavy doses of the primary language, that child's emotional need for love is going to be met in a more effective way. And if you, and when you have to discipline a child, for example, because of disobedience, if you give the child an expression of love in the child's love language before you administer the discipline, and maybe after you administer the discipline is received in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But if the child has an empty love tank and then you just come in and do the discipline, even though it might be very positive discipline, the child might, will likely rebel against it and feel like it's unfair.
Right.
Because they don't feel loved by the parents. So I'm trying to help single parents, you know, parent more effectively by understanding the love language of the child.
We're coming close to the end, and there's one of the languages that most people don't talk about, and I want to make sure we do before the end, and that's number five, the issue of touch.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people that I know, I've done a lot of work with addictions, and particularly sex addiction and things like that, and a lot of people are reaching out for nurturing and physical contact and express it, so to speak, by thinking it has to be genital or orgasmic or somehow sexual as their only way of getting touched.
Yeah.
And so what do you talk to about singles who have this need for touch, a desire to touch and be touched physically, and to do it in a way that's healthy and appropriate and not feeding into their own self-destructive behaviors?
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. And, you know, a lot of the couples who read my original book, the men would automatically say, oh, my love language is physical touch, by which they meant sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, wait a minute, I'm not sure that's true. Do you enjoy non-sexual touches? You know, if your wife just puts her arm around your shoulder, do you feel loved? Because if you don't feel deeply loved by non-sexual touches, then that's probably not your love language. It's just, you know, you're motivated strongly sexually, and you want your sexual needs to be met, but that's probably not what makes you feel loved emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're wise to separate the two. We're not, when I say physical touch, it's not to be equated with sexual touch, though certainly sexual touch can be affirming.
Right.
But I think you're right. A lot of singles violate each other sometimes when they focus on sexual touch without having much of a relationship, and consequently the relationship simply becomes you know, a physical thrill for a moment, but there's not much of a relationship there.
Well, I know that with a lot of men in particular, like you were saying, they've not been taught that it's okay to touch another man.
Right.
It's okay to hug, it's okay to put a hand on a shoulder, that it doesn't necessarily mean a come on or anything else. It's not a strike against their masculinity if they like hugging. As a kid, I was always a hugger. They could always count on me to being affectionate. That was the favorite of all the aunts and uncles because of it. But it also, I think my brothers and I now are big huggers with each other. My dad and I, you know, are big huggers with each other. And many of my male clients, because when it's appropriate and when it's okay, you know, I'm a hugger even with my clients.
Yeah,
And they feed off of it, and I'm known as a hugger, and I've had people go out of their way to say, I just need one of your hugs, Stuart, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
The importance of being grounded in that, whether you're a man or a woman, and I think a lot of women are starving for it because the men, like you said, associate the physical with it implying sex, and don't know how to be held by the women in their lives, and let them hold them, because they think it's too emasculating, and yet very often, you know, I mean, a big football player needs to curl up in somebody's arms once in a while and be held.
Absolutely.
You know?
And that's why, you know, I give it as one of the five fundamental languages of love.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody needs to be touched. And in all societies, there are appropriate touches and inappropriate touches.
Right.
And we have to learn what those are. But within that framework, we express love by affirming physical touch. And whether it's with the same sex or across sexual lines, it's really not a genital thing. It's an emotional thing. And I think, you walk up to a fellow worker, let's say physical touch is your language or one of your strong languages, and you walk up to a fellow worker and you give him a hug and maybe he stiffens up, and you realize that he hadn't received love in physical touch probably, and that's probably not one of his
topics. It's always important to ask permission for something
that's right.
Because there's a real physical boundary issue for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. So I think, as singles, we have to recognize that and not impose our love language on the other person and assume that they will appreciate it as much as we appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. One suggestion I often give, particularly singles, when they have that skin hunger and need for it, is a professional massage as often as they can afford it, without overdoing it, in other words, knowing that even though you're paying that individual, that hour on the table you are receiving. And you can relax into it, and your cells are getting, it's good for your physical health as well as your spiritual health,
right,
I believe.
Right. Yeah, right. And Stuart, one of the points I'm making in the book, and I don't want to leave without making sure I've said this, I'm not suggesting that you speak only the person's primary love language. What I'm saying is, if you understand that out of the five, most people have a primary language, if you will speak heavy doses of that, then sprinkle in the other four, then the other four will be meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't speak their primary love language, you can speak the other four and the person still not feel loved. And that's where many people just don't understand it. They say, look what I've done, this, and why don't they feel loved? But the problem is they haven't spoken the primary love language.
I agree with you totally. That's the same thing I said at the very beginning, just talking about the two languages that a lot of couples are misreading, which is some people talk from an emotional vocabulary and others from an intellectual vocabulary. And the emotional needs to learn some of the words that the intellectual will hear, and the intellectual needs to learn some of the words that the emotional will hear. And to start understanding the difference. And what you've done with these five languages is actually expand that, I think, in a beautiful way to much more specifics and actually actions.
Yes.
And to me, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And one of the things I did in this book, Stuart, at the back of the book, we have a love language profile where the single makes 30 choices between two things. For example, I feel really loved when people give me a hug, or I feel really loved when a friend takes a walk with me. Okay, one is quality time, one is physical touch. But if I could only have one of those, which one would I choose?
Wow.
And so you make 30 choices, and then you add it up, and it tells you what your love language is.
Wow.
It tells you the one you chose most often. So I'm hoping that's going to be a tool that will help couples, discover their own love language. It's something they'll share with their friends and become a discussion, starter, and help couples communicate about this whole area of love.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure people know how to get more information about you. I know you have the five love languages and the five love languages for singles. You also deal with five love languages for men, and you have books and articles, and you even do a weekly radio show yourself, don't you?
I do, yeah.
How can people reach you? I know that you have the website moodypublishing.org.
Yeah, and another one, good one would be fivelovelanguages.com.
Five written out F-I-D-E?
Right, F-I-V-E, fivelovelanguages.com.
Okay.
And incidentally, they can actually get a study guide. They can download a study guide at that website that goes with the book, The Five Love Languages for Singles.
Which actually I downloaded this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. So.
Good.
What about your radio show? When is it on? Where is it on?
I do a little daily 90-second daily on marriage, just a marriage thought every day. It's on 100 stations around the country.
Excellent.
But at this website, they can also get that online as well.
Excellent. Again, I know it was very short notice, but I really appreciate you taking time away from your family on this Labor Day weekend to join us on the show. And it's actually been my pleasure getting acquainted with you and getting a few more tools to work with my own clients and to apply to myself.
Well, so, good, Stuart. I enjoyed being with you today. It was good to chatting with you. East Coast, West Coast.
That's right.
That's great.
It's a small globe with today's technology.
Absolutely.
So, again, I want to thank you for being on the show, and in a few closing words here, I want to invite all of you to make sure that you know that if you want to hear the show again or want a friend to listen to the show, in about a week or so it'll be archived along with the last 3 years of my shows at tellthetruthfaster.com, and you can read some articles on there. And if you want to email me to comment on the show or make some suggestions, I really enjoy getting your emails. You can email me on the website, tellthetruthfaster.com. And in closing, again, I want to remind everybody that it's their own personal responsibility to live our lives to the fullest and to create the level of peace in our hearts that we really all strive for. There is a difficult time in creating peace in the world if we don't start within our own hearts and our own lives. And while everything around us may seem overwhelming, with even the election coming up, I want to say a prayer out to the families in Russia where this horrible terrorist thing has happened in the last few days and all the children that have died, and to family and friends and total strangers that I know in Florida who are dealing with Hurricane Francis right now. I want to send our best wishes out to President Clinton for a speedy recovery. All of this, whether you believe in or agree with the philosophy and the approach to President Clinton or not, this is a chance to kind of open up and understand that human suffering is human suffering. Whether somebody agrees with you philosophically or not, somebody's life is on the line, his health is on the line, and it's, I think, taking the higher road to put everyone in their prayers. I pray for John Kerry, I pray for President Bush. And this is an important thing, because no matter what goes on around us, the peace in us is what affects peace country and in our lives and in our families and in our hearts. So with that being said, I want to thank all of you for listening, and tune in next week. Over the next few weeks, I'll be doing some shows on Native American issues, on HIV in the Native American community, on mental health issues of the Native American community. I'll be having an old friend of mine on, who's a personal friend of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and at her funeral today, and my condolences go out to her family. So, we're all true with Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM.